Chapter 6. Incomplete. I don't remember high school very well, because I spent so much of it asleep, compensating for all my insomniac nights on the computer. At Arundel High, most of my teachers didn't mind my little napping habit and left me alone so long as I wasn't snoring, though there were still a cruel, joyless few who considered it their duty to always wake me with the screech of chalk or the clap of erasers, and ambush me with the question, "And what do you think, Mr. Snowden?" I'd lift my head off my desk, sit up in my chair, yawn, and, as my classmates tried to stifle their laughter, I'd have to answer. The truth is, I loved these moments, which were among the greatest challenges high school had to offer. I loved being put on the spot, groggy and dazed, with 30 pairs of eyes and ears trained on me and expecting my failure while I searched for a clue on the half-empty blackboard. If I could think quickly enough to come up with a good answer, I'd be a legend. But if I was too slow, I could always crack a joke. It's never too late for a joke. In the absolute worst case, I'd sputter, and my classmates would think I was stupid. Let them. You should always let people underestimate you, because when people misappraise your intelligence and abilities, they're merely pointing out their own vulnerabilities, the gaping holes in their judgment that need to stay open if you want to cartwheel through later on a flaming horse correcting the record with your sword of justice. When I was a teen, I think I was a touch too enamored of the idea that life's most important questions are binary, meaning that one answer is always right and all the rest of the answers are wrong. I think I was enchanted by the model of computer programming, whose questions can only be answered in one of two ways, one or zero, the machine code version of yes or no, true or false. Even the multiple choice questions of my quizzes and tests could be approached through the oppositional logic of the binary. If I didn't immediately recognize one of the possible answers as correct, I could always try to reduce my choices by a process of elimination, looking for terms such as always or never and seeking out invalidating exceptions. Toward the end of my freshman year, however, I was faced with a very different kind of assignment, a question that couldn't be answered by filling in bubbles with a number two pencil, but only by rhetoric, full sentences in full paragraphs. In plain terms, it was an English class assignment, a writing prompt. Please produce an autobiographical statement of no fewer than 1,000 words. I was being ordered by strangers to divulge my thoughts on perhaps the only subject on which I didn't have any thoughts, the subject of me, whoever he was. I just couldn't do it. I was blocked. I didn't turn anything in and received an incomplete. My problem, like the prompt itself, was personal. I couldn't produce an autobiographical statement because my life at the time was too confusing. This was because my family was falling apart. My parents were getting a divorce. It all happened so fast. My father moved out, and my mother put the house in Crofton on the market, and then moved with my sister and me into an apartment, and then into a condominium in a development in nearby Ellicott City. I've had friends tell me that you aren't really an adult until you bury a parent or become one yourself. But what no one ever mentions is that for kids of a certain age, divorce is like both of those happening simultaneously. Suddenly, the invulnerable icons of your childhood are gone. In their stead, if there's anyone at all, is a person even more lost than you are, full of tears and rage, who craves your reassurance that everything will turn out okay. It won't, though. At least not for a while. As the custody and visitation rights were being sorted by the courts, my sister threw herself into college applications, was accepted, and started counting down the days until she'd leave for the University of North Carolina at Wilmington. Losing her meant losing my closest tie to what our family had been. I reacted by turning inward. I buckled down and willed myself into becoming another person, a shapeshifter putting on the mask of whoever the people I cared about needed at the time. Among family, I was dependable and sincere. Among friends, mirthful and unconcerned. But when I was alone, I was subdued, even morose, and constantly worried about being a burden. I was haunted by all the road trips to North Carolina I'd complained through, all the Christmases I'd ruined by bringing home bad report cards, all the times I'd refused to get offline and do my chores. Every childhood fuss I'd ever made flickered in my mind like crime scene footage, evidence that I was responsible for what had happened. I tried to throw off the guilt by ignoring my emotions and feigning self-sufficiency, until I projected a sort of premature adulthood. I stopped saying that I was playing with the computer and started saying that I was working on it. Just changing those words, without remotely changing what I was doing, made a difference in how I was perceived by others and even by myself. I stopped calling myself Eddie. From now on, I was Ed. I got my first cell phone, which I wore clipped to my belt like a grown-ass man. The unexpected blessing of trauma, the opportunity for reinvention, taught me to appreciate the world beyond the four walls of home. I was surprised to find that as I put more and more distance between myself and the two adults who loved me the most, I came closer to others who treated me like a peer. Mentors who taught me to sail, trained me to fight, coached me in public speaking, and gave me the confidence to stand on stage, all of them helped to raise me. At the beginning of my sophomore year, though, I started getting tired a lot and falling asleep more than usual, not just at school anymore, but now even at the computer. I'd wake up in the middle of the night in a more or less upright position, the screen in front of me full of gibberish because I'd passed out atop the keys. Soon enough, my joints were aching, my nodes were swollen, the whites of my eyes turned yellow, and I was too exhausted to get out of bed, even after sleeping for 12 hours or more at a stretch. After having had more blood taken from me than I'd ever imagined was in my body, I was eventually diagnosed with infectious mononucleosis. It was both a seriously debilitating and seriously humiliating illness for me to have, not least because it's usually contracted through what my classmates called hooking up, and at age 15, the only hooking up I'd ever done involved a modem. School was totally forgotten, my absences piled up, and not even that made me happy. Not even an all-ice-cream diet made me happy. I barely had the energy to do anything but play the games my parents gave me, each of them trying to bring the cooler game, the newer game, as if they were in a competition to perk me up or mitigate their guilt about the divorce. When I no longer had it in me to even work a joystick, I wondered why I was alive. Sometimes I'd wake up unable to recognize my surroundings. It would take me a while to figure out whether the dimness meant that I was at my mother's condo or my father's one bedroom, and I'd have no recollection of having been driven between them. Every day became the same. It was a haze. I remember reading The Conscience of a Hacker, a.k.a. The Hacker's Manifesto, Neal Stephenson's Snow Crash, and reams of J.R.R. Tolkien. Falling asleep mid-chapter and getting the characters and action confused until I was dreaming that Gollum was by my bedside and whining,
"Master, Master, information wants to be free."
While I was resigned to all the fever dreams sleep brought me, the thought of having to catch up on my schoolwork was the true nightmare. After I'd missed approximately 4 months of class, I got a letter in the mail from Arundel High informing me that I'd have to repeat my sophomore year. I'd say I was shocked, but the moment I read the letter, I realized that I'd known this was inevitable and had been dreading it for weeks. The prospect of returning to school, let alone of repeating two semesters, was unimaginable to me, and I was ready to do whatever it took to avoid it. Just at the point when my glandular disease had developed into a full-on depression, receiving the school news shook me out of my slump. Suddenly I was upright and getting dressed in something other than pajamas. Suddenly I was online and on the phone, searching for the system's edges, searching for a hack. After a bit of research and a lot of form filling, my solution landed in the mailbox. I'd gotten myself accepted to college. Apparently, you don't need a high school diploma to apply. Anne Arundel Community College was a local institution, certainly not as venerable as my sister's school, but it would do the trick. All that mattered was that it was accredited. I took the offer of admission to my high school administrators, who, with a curious and barely concealed mixture of resignation and glee, agreed to let me enroll. I'd attend college classes 2 days a week, which was just about the most that I could manage to stay upright and functional. By taking classes above my grade level, I wouldn't have to suffer through the year I'd missed. I'd just skip it. AACC was about 25 minutes away, and the first few times I drove myself were perilous. I was a newly licensed driver who could barely stay awake at the wheel. I'd go to class and then come directly home to sleep. I was the youngest person in all my classes, and might even have been the youngest person at the school. Alternatively, a mascot-like object of novelty and a discomforting presence. This, along with the fact that I was still recovering, meant that I didn't hang out much. Also, because AACC was a commuter school, it had no active campus life. The anonymity of the school suited me fine, though, as did my classes, most of which were distinctly more interesting than anything I'd napped through at Arundel High. Before I go any further and leave high school forever, I should note that I still owe that English class assignment, the one marked incomplete, my autobiographical statement. The older I get, the heavier it weighs on me, and yet writing it hasn't gotten any easier. The fact is, no one with a biography like mine ever comes comfortably to autobiography. It's hard to have spent so much of my life trying to avoid identification, only to turn around completely and share personal disclosures in a book. The intelligence community tries to inculcate in its workers a baseline anonymity, a sort of blank page personality upon which to inscribe secrecy and the art of imposture. You train yourself to be inconspicuous, to look and sound like others. You live in the most ordinary house. You drive the most ordinary car. You wear the same ordinary clothes as everyone else. The difference is, you do it on purpose. Normalcy, the ordinary, is your cover. This is the perverse reward of a self-denying career that brings no public glory. The private glory comes not during work, but after, when you go back out among other people again and successfully convince them that you're one of them. Though there are a score of more popular and surely more accurate psychological terms for this type of identity split, I tend to think of it as human encryption. As in any process of encryption, the original material, your core identity, still exists, but only in a locked and scrambled form. The equation that enables this ciphering is a simple proportion. The more you know about others, the less you know about yourself. After a time, you might forget your likes and even your dislikes. You can lose your politics, along with any and all respect for the political process that you might have had. Everything gets subsumed by the job, which begins with a denial of character and ends with a denial of conscience. Mission first. Some version of the above served me for years as an explanation of my dedication to privacy and my inability or unwillingness to get personal. It's only now, when I've been out of the IC almost as long as I was in it, that I realize it isn't nearly enough. After all, I was hardly a spy. I wasn't even shaving when I failed to turn in my English class assignment. Instead, I was a kid who'd been practicing spycraft for a while already, partly through my online experiments with game-playing identities, but more than anything, through dealing with the silence and lies that followed my parents' divorce. With that rupture, we became a family of secret keepers, experts at subterfuge and hiding. My parents kept secrets from each other and from me and my sister. My sister and I would eventually keep our own secrets too, when one of us was staying with our father for the weekend and the other was staying with our mother. One of the most difficult trials that a child of divorce has to face is being interrogated by one parent about the new life of the other. My mother would be gone for stretches, back on the dating scene. My father tried his best to fill the void, but at times he would become enraged by the protracted and expensive divorce process. Whenever that happened, it would seem to me as if our roles had reversed. I had to be assertive and stand up to him, to reason with him. It's painful to write this, though not so much because the events of this period are painful to recall, as because they're in no way indicative of my parents' fundamental decency, or of how, out of love for their children, they were eventually able to bury their differences, reconcile with respect, and flourish separately in peace. This kind of change is constant, common, and human. But an autobiographical statement is static, the fixed document of a person in flux. This is why the best account that someone can ever give of themselves is not a statement, but a pledge. A pledge to the principles they value, and to the vision of the person they hope to become. I'd enrolled in community college to save myself time after a setback, not because I intended to continue with my higher education. But I made a pledge to myself that I'd at least complete my high school degree. It was a weekend when I finally kept that promise, driving out to a public school near Baltimore to take the last test I'd ever take for the state of Maryland, the exam for the General Education Development, GED, degree, which the U.S. government recognizes as the standard equivalent to a high school diploma. I remember leaving the exam feeling lighter than ever, having satisfied the 2 years of schooling that I still owed to the state just by taking a 2-day exam. It felt like a hack, but it was more than that. It was me staying true to my word.